Thank you. Welcome to the Green Sustainability Show. And with this show, we talk about all kinds of recycling, sustainability, how to do projects. And with these projects, it always takes money to do the projects. And that's the big thing. No matter what you're doing, it takes a lot of money. And I personally have a project for, I'm building a green farm, which is would be a great thing maybe Stephen can help me with. My guest is Stephen Barr. The thing of it is, with these projects, we need money. And one of the things I'm doing, this green sustainability farm, we need money to build fences. We have a horse rescue. We need money to build the barns, put in water lines. We've also had a homeless shelter, but it all takes money. So, Steve, tell us how you do help people with their money and what you do and all about you. So this is Stephen Barr. Are you there, Steve?
I do a lot of variety of fundraising activities for both nonprofits and for-profit corporations through a variety of means. One of the my primary means is through crowdfunding, through donation-based crowdfunding for nonprofits. And now we've got a change in the regulations finally from the SEC on equity crowdfunding, which will I'll be starting to raise funds in about another 6 months, about 180 days before the regulations take effect, for raising money for profit corporations. but that isn't here yet. But on October 30th, we had the passage of the Title III regulations for the SEC. So it's the first time in 81 years that non-accredited people can invest in corporations. There's some fairly stringent regulations that go along with that, of course. But since the stock market crash in 1929, when the SEC was formulated to protect people from investing, a lot of people lost everything in a stock market crash. So that's why the government formed the SEC to protect consumers from fraudulent or from just uninformed investments, making uninformed investments.
Right.
So the regulations were very stiff. You had to have over $1 million liquid in the bank and or make more than $200,000 for the past 2 years.
Right.
In order to qualify to invest in stocks in new corporations. So, but now that is going by the wayside with this new Title III, the government has eased up to spur investment.
Well, that's great.
Quite frankly, the little guy is asked more questions on investments than the big guys do, really. So, I think the law, it's about time we changed it because if you're investing, you're only $5,000, you got to invest. You're a lot tougher than somebody that's got a couple $1 million in the bank, or $5,000 is pocket change to them, so they don't really care.
Exactly.
I think it'll be good for the economy once we get it shaken out. So I do equity crowdfunding. That means you get a piece of the company. I will be doing that, but primarily for nonprofits. Now, is your horse thing a nonprofit?
Yes, I'm a 501c.
Okay, so
and we've been in business for over 20 years.
For them. Correct?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
If you solicit donations, any donations that you solicit, you could even do a car wash or sell cookies outside the grocery store, whatever, to raise funds. There's all kinds of fundraising things you can do for a nonprofit that you're not giving up equity in that nonprofit. You're doing a donation base because it's tax deductible to the donor.
Correct.
They can take it off their income tax. So it's not so hard for a nonprofit. That's why there was always that difference. A lot of companies, especially this time of year, coming into the end of the year, there's a lot of corporate. You go after corporate sponsors. They're looking for a tax write-off because they're getting close to the end of their fiscal year if they're using a calendar year. And they need a write-off. So October and November is like the big time where a lot of the nonprofits have their annual Monte Carlo night or whatever their fundraising is, because people are looking for a write-off.
Right.
So
yeah, we have several.
That way. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say we have several projects. We are, maybe you can help us with. We actually are working with the Wild Horses, making a documentary on that. And if there was a place, we have a person that could look after them. I would like to get some crowdfunding so he can have a salary. Also, we have rescue horses. It'd be nice to have something like to help with their feed. And then, of course, we're building the Green Ranch, and that's going to be educational. We're going to be working with ASU on that and hopefully make it a satellite campus. And that could be something. So we'll talk about that after the show. But it's so exciting. Now, how does crowdfunding work exactly?
Well, crowdfunding, I'll take it for the instance of the nonprofit for now. There's many different platforms, Kickstarter, Indiegogo, GoFundMe. There's over almost 200 now that have popped up. But the major ones that everybody's probably familiar with would be Indiegogo and Kickstarter, or GoFundMe if they're on Facebook. Who isn't on Facebook? You've seen them where they, you donate $5, you get a T-shirt. You donate $25, you get a T-shirt and framed plaque. And you donate $75, you get tickets to the annual ball. If you donate $250, you get your name listed on all the programs. $500, you're a charter member. And that's how traditional nonprofits have always raised their money. They go out and solicit the community. And corporations, both individuals and corporate sponsors, because for both of them, it is tax deductible, and they have charity galas or Monte Carlo nights or whatever. Baked food sales, it goes right back to the baked food sale for the Girl Scouts, and stuff like that. It's tax deductible, and you can raise, there's no limit on to what they can raise, and it's tax free to the nonprofit. And it's tax-free to the donors. So it's a win-win situation. People, especially getting towards the end of the year, they're looking for a tax deduction. So those programs or those platforms are pretty self-starting. You can just log in there, and they have, templates already there for you. It's very easy to set up. If you set up your Facebook profile, you can set one of these up. The crowdfunding campaign. Now, the key.
That does sound easy.
It is very easy, but that's just like the top tip of the iceberg. Getting it up there, there's a lot of competition out there. How do you get yours? There's a lot of people can. For every dollar that's donated, there's probably 100 people that need a dollar. So, you're competing against other nonprofits for that same dollar. There's limited.
How do we do that?
How do you market your crowdfunding campaign? Getting it up onto the platform is only the first step. You got to get people to that platform, to your campaign on that platform, and you got to get them to click the donation button. So that would be marketing. Marketing the crowdfunding campaign, that's the aspect that most people aren't getting. They put something up on Indiegogo and it's just there and it dies. They don't get any money. And they say, this crowdfunding is a bunch of crap. But, it's not.
Right.
There's a lot of people. There's, just everybody's on social media today. Everybody's got Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn. And you need somebody to effectively, and that's where I come in. I assist people once they get a crowdfunding campaign up and going, is getting attraction to it. You got to do press releases. You got to do radio shows like this right here. You've got to do social media links, and if you do get a corporate sponsor, get them to put it onto their mailing list. You got to do email campaigns. It's a lot of work, and typically you have a limited time frame. It's up for 10 days or 2 weeks, so you don't put the thing up and then think, how am I going to market it? Because by the time you get it up and going, it's going to be too late. Your campaign will be over. So it's something that I would suggest a 90-day window on. You start the project 90 days before it, that you collect a dime and get everything in place.
Right.
You know?
So plan before you do it.
Pardon me. But, you know, there in Phoenix, you got Scott Kelly at Black Dog Productions, who's a great guy.
Yeah, I know Scott. He's nice.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's working with a platform that I also work with, crowdfunder.com, and he's doing some equity crowdfunding already for some startups. He's probably busier than a shithouse mouse. I know Scott is he's hired some people, and he's very busy, but he'd be a guy I'd recommend in the Phoenix market, at least. He's got the ties. He's a PR guy. There's other people there in Scottsdale and Phoenix that do campaigns. A guy named Mark Cohen is a friend of mine that is over there, and he does more institutional fundraising rather than consumer based. You know, if you want corporate donations, you know, there's a lot of marketing companies there. I'd be happy to do it remote, but I'm only in Phoenix a third of the time. I spend the other time in L.A. and Vegas. I have three offices, so I'm spread pretty thin.
Hey, Steve, this is Steve Nascio's brother. How you doing?
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Well, I'm doing good, Bill. What's the typical cost on that? If you hire someone or you bring someone in for crowdfunding, how expensive is it?
That's all over the board. So I would say minimally, just to get anybody minimally to do some basic PR and social media, you'd be talking $500 to $750. But a full campaign, no more than $2,500, I wouldn't think.
Okay. And on a $2,500 expenditure on a campaign, what kind of assurances do you have? You know, obviously it's going to have to be a good cause. Obviously it has something that resonates with people, that they have an interest to it, but what's your likelihood of being successful? In other words, you know, if people will pay the $25 and then get $600 back.
Anybody that would have an unsuccessful campaign, I wouldn't pay anybody up front. I'd give them maybe half up front and half on completion. You know, that's the way I do it, 50-50.
Okay, that's pretty much the industry norm.
There is no regulation on crowdfunding consultants, so. Crowdfunding has only been around for about 3 years, total of 4 years from
right.
the conception. And there is FIFRA, which is the Crowdfunding Intermediary Regulatory Agency. And then there's I belong to the National Crowdfunding Association. And then there's a Standards and Practices Committees. And I belong to that as well. But there is no governmental regulatory agency regulating crowdfunding consultants like there would be, say, for realtors or for accountants or for attorneys. There is no, not yet. It's in the works. It's coming. So, but, you know, common sense prevails. You know, you want to take a look at somebody's, have them show you what campaigns have you done. Give me an example of one that you've done that's closed successfully. You know, I mean, a lot of these campaigns, if they're advertised and marketed properly, you know, you set a goal of, say, $25,000. Some of these campaigns have been blowing out 10 times the goal. I mean, they had a goal of $25,000, and they go viral, and it's something that people want. And I've seen them go for you know, $1 million when they had a goal of $25,000. So it's not necessarily, it's not always the case where they have a hard time making the goal. A lot of times they blow way past the goal. So effective, you know, search engine optimization and viral campaign email and social media campaign is critical to success.
No, that sounds good. And you just, like, even we have a specific, like, if we got a bunch of horses in, it'd be nice just to have money to pay the farrier to do all their feet. I mean, horses cost a lot when you have a horse rescue and you want to be able to pay everyone involved. And that way I know their feet will be done at least. So there's a lot of things we need. Maybe, again, after the show, we can talk, figure out some different things we need for our charity. And then what kind of projects have you done in the past, Steve? Steven. Are you there? Are you there,
well, I
Steve?
I hope we didn't lose you, Joe.
Well, we might have. We've got, it is about 4:20, and we will be ending our green sustainability show. But our next show is Dr. Love Connection, and we have another guest. That's Tim Nichols from L.A. will be calling in. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the things we do in our at our green farm that we're building until Tim calls in, because we might have lost Stephen. But what we're doing, what we're wanting to do is build a green farm, build windmills. We're going to work with a windmill manufacturing company and work with ASU and actually keep records of what this windmill does. Is he back on the line?
Yeah, I'm back here.
Okay, good. So, Stephen, I was asking what kind of projects you do.
Oh, I do. I do all kinds of projects. I do. I'm doing one. I kind of specialize in the. I call it the island of misfit startups. You know, the ones
okay,
that don't
that's,
fit into
that's me.
The oddballs. I pick up the oddballs. I do the ones, you know, because all these startups, like last year, they were all doing. Everybody was coming out with a mobile app. They wanted to do a mobile gaming app or something like that. And I've got a guy that's Micro Launchers is a company that is building satellite delivery systems, rockets. But they're going nanotechnology, so they're going smaller rather than bigger. I mean, some of these rockets are going to be about to, you know, be 6 feet tall. But they can get 50 satellites up a month for $50,000 a shot versus multiple millions or billions of dollars going up to a SpaceX. And so I'm developing with that. I work a lot in the environmental sciences and medical technologies. I've got a company where the Dell's invented and patented a peripheral for a computer that has about 5 billion customers worldwide. Any medical professional does any charting and any medical thing, she has a side keyboard that adds up to your computer that has a shorthand for medical shorthand. So you type this one button, and it fills out a whole sentence for you. So any nurse out
wow.
there that's been working the night shift doing all the charting would love to have this thing. So that's one that's coming up. A whole plethora of
things. These are for profit, though, correctly. I mean,
these are
not crowdfunding projects. These are just projects that you're putting together.
I'm selling stock in equity in these through a broker dealer to raise capital to get these manufacturing.
Are they Regulation D offerings, or what kind of offers are they?
Yeah. They'd be Regulation Reg D offerings.
Okay. All right.
And I have a syndicate on AngelList. So I'm syndicated through AngelList. I have my own syndicate there where I offer them up, and they're AngelList people, and their broker dealer handles all the paperwork for me. So I don't have to get into the regulatory pitfalls that some people might get into.
No, that's fantastic. So you have good broker dealers that you have associations with that you go to them and say, look, I've got this project here, and here's how it's laid out.
I go through crowdfunder.com or through AngelList, angel.co. I have my own syndicate there. This is Mark Cuban and Barbara Corcoran from Shark Tank. So people can go there. If I register, I list one of mine. I've got one coming out next week. That's a subscription box service. You know how you can sign up for these subscription services, get a great discount, and they send you a different box every month. And this is for little girls' clothes up to from infant to I guess size 8. And there's currently none in that arena. So it's an untapped market, and it's a proven business model. It's a subscription service.
All those sound excellent. I'm a little confused, though. You said you're going through, like, crowdfunding, but something like this, crowdfunding is typically for, like, a 501c, typically, though, a nonprofit. You're not going through crowdfunding for something for profit, though, are you? Or explain that to me.
I have my own store on Indiegogo for the nonprofits. For the nonprofit donation-based.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that I need to have Don tell me when my next guest is on. Is he on the line yet? Don will tell me when our next guest, but keep talking, Steve, and then they'll let me know when you get Tim on the line. I guess he's not on the line yet. Go ahead.
I'm just trying to understand how a person, the money that you're raising for profit, you're going through broker dealers. So it has nothing to do with crowdfunding.
I'm syndicating it, and it goes up on a crowdfunding. There's two types of crowdfunding. There's equity-based crowdfunding, and then there's donation-based crowdfunding.
Okay, well, equity-based, I wasn't even aware you could do equity-based crowdfunding right now.
No, you do it with me, right? I'm AngelList. And right now it's only open to accredited investors, the people with the $2 million or more. But passage of the Title III, in about 180 days, it'll be open to non-accredited as well. So the floodgates are going to open on that. But there's a lot of additional regulation that comes along with it. It's a lot of responsibility. There's a lot more financial disclosure. They can only raise up to $1 million in a 12-month period. They have to make significant disclosures to the SEC, and they have to file an annual report with the SEC. And they have to provide audited financials to investors annually. So full financial disclosure is part of it, and a lot of small companies won't want that onerous of having to do all that compliance. Just for a small company raising $1 million or less, they don't want to have to hire a compliance officer to do it. So that's where some of these platforms that have integrated broker dealers on staff, like AngelList. So I can syndicate without being a registered broker-dealer myself, because it's overseen by the AngelList people. So they do it all for me. I take a carry. They get a carry.
Investors just get equity in the company.
Okay.
Perfect.
Or it could be done as a convertible note too. So they could be a return on investment. It could be a direct return with payments and dividends on the note. A combination of the two.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder where you could do that right now. So that's good.
Oh yeah, yeah. I can only do it for accredited investors right now.
Same people are qualified for the Reg D. Yeah, sure, I get it.
Yeah. But for Joe's horse nonprofit there, I would take it to Indiegogo. The big difference here is two things. One thing, I like Indiegogo because for the donation base, because if you don't meet your goal on Indiegogo, say you put up a goal of trying to raise $25,000, and you get up to $17,500. On most platforms, if you don't make that goal of $25,000, you get none of it. It all gets returned back to the donors unless you meet your goal.
That's terrible.
Indiegogo lets you keep whatever you collect, even if you don't make your goal. That's why I went with that platform. The Title III rate state for the equity ones, that if they don't meet your goal, they will have to give it back. So you don't want to set your goal too high on those.
Right. You want to do it and hope it goes over.
On the nonprofit,
I would think something like Joe's, something with wild horses. People love animals, and I can't imagine why that wouldn't just fly through a 501c. I just don't know why that wouldn't work.
Well, I would tie that in with the movie, with the film you're doing.
And we'd like to raise some money to pay for the person to watch over them, and that way the horses are looked after, and that person has a salary. But yeah, we're doing the film, and we could tie it all in. It would be perfect.
Yeah, you're probably going to be shooting it with a drone, aren't you? You're going to have a drone just with a
We're
going to
have a
camera.
Drone and some just several different cameras. But yeah, we're definitely going to have a drone.
Yeah.
So you got to come along with us, Stephen, on one of these rides and be adventurous with us. You got to come.
I'm a New York City boy. I'm not too used to riding horses, but that's okay.
Okay, I appreciate everything. You've given us a lot of ideas. I'm not sure if our Tim Nichols is on the line yet. I suppose he's not.
Yeah, I hope but, it's Arizona time, not California time, Joe. I was just sitting here wondering that. Did you tell him Arizona time?
I told him California. Yes. Oh, he's here?
Hello.
Okay, well, you can goodbye, Stephen. I'm going to talk to Tim Nichols
call
now.
Me anytime.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. So that concludes our Green Sustainability Show, and now we are on Dr. Love with Tim Nichols, and Tim is in California. How are you doing, Tim? Tim, are you there?
Tom Horn?
You have Tom Horn on the line.
Yes, Tom Horn is here.
Okay.
Hi, Tom. All right, well, confusing. So I guess we had another guest from California that never did call in. So that's good. We got Tom for the next 30 minutes. And this is Interviews with Joe Long. And Tom is in New York. Tom was the past attorney general for the state of Arizona. And he has a Harvard Law degree. He's a magnificent attorney. He does have a law practice here in Scottsdale, Arizona. And welcome, Tom. How are you?
Hi, Joe. It's good to talk with you.
Thanks for calling in, and thanks for being on our radio show. I wanted to let people know about your wonderful education and some of the things you've done with your law practice. First of all, can you tell them a little bit about your education, which is quite impressive?
Well, I went to Harvard College, and I graduated magna cum laude from Harvard College, and then I graduated from the Harvard Law School with honors. So I did well in law school.
Oh, that's amazing. Yes, that's amazing. So, and your specialty in law, you love a fight, you love to win, and so if somebody gets tangled up with a bad guy, I think they would definitely want to call you. So tell us tell us about that.
Well, I'm a litigator, so I'm the guy that likes to go to the courtroom. I like to fight for people. So whether any of your listeners have a divorce or a personal injury or a commercial dispute or a criminal charge, I'm the guy for them. I'm not necessarily the guy to keep corporate minute books, but I'm the guy to go in and fight for you.
Right. It seems like there's so many crooks nowadays. People get in some kind of partnership with the wrong person, or they get lied to. Actually, yesterday, a man came in. A lady was really treating him bad. She's occupying his ranch. He has a horse boarding facility. She's not paying him board. I told him to call you. I mean, he goes, I don't know what to do. And so maybe he'll call in. I told him that you were going to be on the air. But it's just there's so many times you just need somebody on your side, especially in a big lawsuit with a corporation,
if somebody's got a fight on their hands, I like it. So I take the burden off their shoulders, they can relax, and I take the fight for them.
Right. So tell us about, I know you've had a case that went to the Supreme Court. Tell us about that case. I'd like to hear about that.
Sure. I actually argued two cases to the United States Supreme Court. One of the cases, I think, is fairly well known, was a big issue. It had to do with the fact that, we have ID at the polls to be sure that the people who vote are citizens. But in addition to ID at the polls, there's a big question of what happens when you register to vote. And so In Arizona, we say in order to register to vote, you have to give proof of citizenship, which for over 90% of people is just their driver's license, because driver's license is, although as a legal resident non-citizen, you can get a driver's license, but there's something in the code on the driver's license that tells you that. So they check citizenship when you get driver's license. So over 90% of the people can prove it just by writing down the number on their driver's license, or it can be a passport, which you need to go to Mexico these days, or it can be a birth certificate. There are a lot of different ways that you can prove citizenship. And we had to go to the U.S. Supreme Court to argue that. You know, there's a myth that has been promulgated by our newspaper and other people in the media that there's no such thing as voter fraud, that it's all an invention. And the only reason we want people to identify themselves is you know, to suppress the minority vote. And this is not true. We actually had a trial in which we proved that voter fraud really is a serious problem in Arizona. And one of the ways
we proved that is that
when people, you know, when the jury commissioner sends out forms to serve on jury duty, you can get out of it by saying you're not a citizen. But when the jury commissioner gets those forms, he sends them to the county recorder to check if they're registered to vote. And they found in 1 year over 200 people who swore on their jury commissioner form that they weren't citizens had registered to vote. Well, the jury commissioner only sent those forms to less than 10% of the people. So we know at least 2,000 or more people who are registered to vote are not citizens. It's a myth that there's no voter fraud. There is voter fraud, especially organizations like ACORN have been involved in organized efforts to register non-citizens. So that was one case where I went to the U.S. Supreme Court to defend our ability to protect the integrity of our voting, because if people feel that non-citizens can vote and can dilute their vote, then they may not bother to vote, and so it can decrease the voter turnout of the citizens. It decreases commitment to the system if you think the system is dishonest and your vote is being diluted. So I think that's a very important issue. And then the second case I brought to the U.S. Supreme Court was a capital punishment case. It was somebody who, I'll tell you the story. The husband and wife and their 10-year-old son went out to dinner to celebrate the fact that the father had gotten a promotion at his work. When they got home, the front door was open, so the father went in to see what was going on. And the next thing the mother saw was a burglar on top of her husband stabbing him repeatedly. She pleaded with him to stop. He wouldn't stop. She jumped on his back to try to get him to stop. He started stabbing her. She was in intensive care, but she recovered, but her husband died of these multiple stab wounds. It turns out that this burglar was on probation at the time of the burglary and the murder that he committed. And he had violent felonies in his background, so he was deemed dangerous. He was given capital punishment. Well, the Ninth Circuit, which, as you know, is a very liberal circuit, gave an indeterminate suspension of carrying out the capital punishment because he wasn't totally mentally competent. And he couldn't help his lawyer with what's called habeas corpus. That's where you go to the federal court to challenge a state court conviction. Well, you don't need to be able to help your lawyer on habeas corpus because that's a legal issue, not a factual issue. And this delay had gone on for 18 years, and this poor woman who was wanting to see justice done didn't know if she would ever get to see justice done. And she'd gone through that whole roller coaster of emotions thinking that she would see justice done, then there would be a delay, and it had gone on for 18 years. So I took the case to the United States Supreme Court. And I persuaded the United States Supreme Court to overrule the Ninth Circuit unanimously. It was a 9-0 vote. So I not only got the conservatives, but I got Breyer and Sotomayor and Kagan and, all four of the liberals and Ginsburg. So that was a really good victory so that this woman can see some justice done finally after 18 years.
Well, that was a great victory because those people are very liberal, and I don't know how you got them to change your mind, except you are a great litigator, and I know you really study what you're doing, and I know you just worked on it so hard, and you won, and you deserve to win. That is amazing.
Well, I took a month, for each U.S. Supreme Court case, I take a month where I tell people, no, I close my door and I say, nobody can talk to me. So I can study it, and then I have six practice arguments. So by the time I got to the U.S. Supreme Court, I was ready for anything.
Wow. That is so interesting. And, yeah, you did prepare, and that's good. And that's why when people have a case, if they go to you, because I know how you are, you give it your all. And so many other attorneys, they don't give it their all, and it's such a difference. I mean, you really get into it, and you want to win because that's how you are. You want to win. And
yeah,
also,
and Joe,
I had a question.
If people want to read about me, that there's a online service called Avvo, AVVO, .com,
okay,
which rates lawyers. So if they go on Avvo and they put in my name, Tom Horn, then they can read about what my clients have said about me. All the about a number of clients who have gone on there, and they've all given me 5 stars out of a possible 5 stars. So, so far, I still have a perfect record of my evaluations by my clients.
Well, and tell us your number to get a hold of you, and also your address if they want to come by your office and make an appointment. Tell us that contact information.
Yeah, well, you know, if they go through Avvo to read about what my clients have said in order to make sure they want to call me, the number's on there. If they just want to call me directly, it's 480-483-2178.
Okay, great. So if they did have a question or wanted to make an appointment, they could just call you direct.
Yeah, or they could look up our website. It's hornslaton.com. It's HORNESLATON. That's one of my partners. hornslaton.com.
So you primarily do litigation, but your law firm also does even things like family law as well. Is that correct?
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
you do a variety. It's not,
if somebody's getting a divorce or they have problems with visitation or custody of the children or whatever, that's a form of litigation. You have to go to court for that. That's a fight. So
right.
You have to fight for that.
That is a fight. It's a dirty yeah. fight most of the time too. Unfortunately.
Sometimes
so
it's
also
very emotional.
Go ahead. Yeah,
hello?
Isn't it kind of hard if the husband and wife are not talking, and then I guess you have to go talk to your attorneys instead of talk to the you're always talking to the other attorney.
Divorces often are very emotional, and we lawyers have to understand that people can be extremely upset when they're going through a divorce. But
so you have to handle it in a certain way.
If I take the fight off their shoulders, hopefully they feel better.
Yeah. Well, you certainly give people relief when they do contact you and employ you, and they know that they've got a soldier, they got a fighting man on their team. Also, I wanted you to tell us about, you had a case about a bridge over by Lake Roosevelt. I wanted to hear about that bridge. I know that there was some problems with the bridge. You have that in your office, that picture of the bridge going near Apache Lake.
Or, in that case, that the bridge at Lake Roosevelt, for those of your listeners who have been there, is the 10th largest single-span bridge in the whole world. And it's very aesthetic. It's won prizes for being a very aesthetically built bridge. One of the things that's unique about it is that it's made out of two materials. Most of the arch that holds up the bridge is steel, but at the bottom it's concrete because the lake goes up and down, and you don't want the lake going and getting the steel wet because it could rust. So they have concrete at the bottom, which doesn't rust. It can take the water. Now, the thing about concrete is it has a lot of compressive strength. You could try to compress concrete, and it'll hold up very well. But it doesn't take what you call moment. Moment is a movement, kind of a circular movement. If you have a kind of a circular movement, you'll get a crack in concrete. So in order to build this bridge, once you got to the middle and the two sides met each other in this arch, the slightest movement would cause the concrete to crack. So you needed a contractor with very good equipment to be able to do it very accurately. Well, the contractor who got the bid didn't have the necessary equipment to do it, so he had to be replaced. So he sued the state for millions of dollars, saying that they presented him with too difficult of a problem. And at that time, I was representing the state, and I said, well, you know, you bid on the job. You were representing that you could do it, and you couldn't. And we won that case. So there was a big picture of the bridge that was used as an exhibit, and I got to take it home, which made me happy because Lake Roosevelt's one of my favorite places. They used to have a motel right on the lake where you could watch the sunrise over the lake in the morning. And it had no TV, so my kids had to talk to me. So that makes Lake Roosevelt one of my favorite places. Now the federal government came along and they destroyed the motel to put in a visitor center, which just shows how this federal government always knows how to screw things up.
Okay, well, that is so interesting. It's beautiful there, and that is a beautiful bridge. Beautiful.
Yeah.
And also, you wrote the book on Arizona construction law. So
I did.
How long did that take you to write?
It took me about 6 years to write it. It's a book published by the State Bar of Arizona, and I wrote it between 1972 and 1978. It was first published in 1978, and then there was a second edition, I think, in 1996. And almost every year we do a supplement. The supplement goes in the back of the book, so we keep it up to date.
Wow, so you actually will continue on working on that for a long time as the years pass. Then you keep up with the instruction log. You are on the cutting edge more than any other person in the state of Arizona on Arizona construction law because you wrote the book. So you're a great attorney for builders, I would think, or anyone in a development with a big problem.
Yeah.
And one of the things, near where I used to live, there was a whole development that they got in a huge lawsuit. They had about 50 or 100 houses that I guess when they built the homes, they didn't really compound the dirt as much, compact the dirt, and they didn't, their footings weren't good. So all the walls started leaning because the clay started expanding and started shrinking and expanding.
And then everything cracks.
Yeah, all these homes cracked. I mean, a whole subdivision. And one day I was driving by, I mean, everybody in that subdivision was moving out. They had to completely redo old foundations on every one of those houses and put in new sheetrock. And the building company got hotels for them. I mean, I can't even imagine the bill on that thing. You take 100 families, put them all in hotels, pay them to move. I mean, the people had to completely move out of the home. They had to completely replace all the walls, all the foundation. It was like a nightmare. I felt so sorry for the building company. They probably needed you at that point.
Well, if you have a builder who's willing to fix it, then that's, you know, that's lucky for the homeowners. The timing of a problem is if they have those kinds of problems and the builder is not willing to fix it. And that's when you need someone
like me. Yeah, so either whether you're one of the homeowners or the builder, of course, the builder will need you to help him, I guess, with his insurance if something like that would happen, to make sure if the insurance. I know when I was a builder, I used to get a homeowner's insurance that would cover any structural damage for 20 years. So if something happened to me, they were covered.
Right, right.
And that was one of my...
builder's insurance will not cover the cost of repairing defects, but it will cover secondary effects. So if, for example, there's a hole in the roof, the cost of fixing the roof isn't covered, but if rain comes in and damages a computer inside, usually the builder's insurance will cover that.
Right. I know it's changed through the years. So there's different insurances. And you could even advise, I know you've talked to many builders, and you probably can advise them what type of insurance to get just to protect them. I mean, the builders are so at risk nowadays. It didn't used to be that way. It was buyer beware. Now it's builder beware. And a good attorney.
Yeah, the policies are pretty standard. So you know that you'll be protected from secondary damage. If you have to make a repair, then you have to pay for that. But if there's secondary damage to something else, then usually the insurance will cover it.
Right. Now, I know you represent and help builders. Have you ever had a big, interesting lawsuit with where you had to help a builder?
Well, a lot of times I've represented builders if they get into conflicts with material suppliers or subcontractors. If somebody, you know, gave them defective work and they were responsible to the owner, and then they had to call the subcontractor or the material supplier to be responsible for the defects that they caused. Or alternatively, sometimes you get a difficult homeowner or a commercial owner who doesn't want to pay. And sometimes you have to sue them, and they make false charges that you did something wrong when you didn't. And so you need a fighter to fight them and make sure that they pay up.
Yeah. So that's the thing. When people don't want to pay, they're always going to say, you didn't keep your word, or you didn't do a job right, or I didn't like your service.
Yeah, they'll make things up.
That's tough.
One thing a lot of builders need to know, sometimes they'll have a contract where it says if the owner orders extra work, he's not responsible to pay for it unless there's a signed written change order that sets forth what the work is and what the price will be. But our
right.
courts have held that even if you don't get that, if the homeowner or the commercial owner tells you to do extra work, by telling you to do extra work orally, he's waiving that provision that says it has to be in writing. So in effect, a provision that says that the changes have to be in writing are unenforceable.
Oh, wow. Because it's an oral contract on top of that, it changed.
Yeah, an oral contract. I mean, it's good business practice, obviously, to document everything in writing. But if you didn't and you're in a fight, a lot of people don't realize, and it's good to let them know that if you were orally told to do the change, it may be harder for you to prove, but the fact that there's something in the contract that says that it's not enforceable unless it's in writing signed by the owner is an unenforceable provision, because if they order you to do it orally, in effect they're waiving that provision.
I see. Well, that's interesting to know. So we should watch what we say and do, and really everything hopefully should be in writing. I think that way you have a good trail. So a smart builder, if the homeowner wants him to add a fireplace or something, the builder needs to have him sign something.
Yeah,
come to you and get some kind of addendum.
Everything. Documenting can be a lot of work, but it's worth it in the long. And if you get into a fight, then documentation can be very valuable.
Yeah. Well, and I hate to say it, but, you know, a lot of these building companies, they're wealthy, they're rich, and they really have to watch it because people just want to sue them to get money. I mean, they'll just make something up.
Either that or they'll want to avoid paying for work that was done, and they'll make something up as an excuse to not pay.
Right.
Now, one of the things that we have in Arizona, Joe, is something called mechanics and materials liens. So if you're a subcontractor or a material supplier and you've supplied materials to somebody's building or done work on someone's building, and he says, well, I paid the general contractor and your contract is with the general contractor, so if he doesn't pay you, that's your problem. In Arizona, we have given people who do work that improves somebody else's property a claim against the property that was improved, to give him an incentive to be sure that if he pays a contractor, the contract pays the people that gave him work. And we call that a material and mechanics lien. And when you have a lien like that, you have to first give a 20-day notice that you're on the job within 20 days of starting the job. And then if you're not paid, you file a lien against the house. So not only the contractor that you had a contractor with, but the owner is responsible to pay you if you did work that improved his property. And if he paid the general contractor and didn't make a joint check or some other method of making sure the general contractor paid you, he may have to pay twice, but he's responsible to see to it that if someone improves his property, they have to get paid.
Oh, wow. So if the contractor was dishonest and got money from the owner and the contractor didn't pay, let's say, his subcontractor, the owner would still be liable if they had filed a materials lien.
Exactly.
To pay the guy that actually did the work.
Yeah, sometimes it happens. You have a contractor who has financial difficulties, and he's getting paid, but he's you know, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. He's moving money around to try to cover his debts, so he gets paid for work,
right.
And he doesn't bother to pay the subcontractor or the material supplier whose work he's getting paid for. Well, the owner
right.
has a responsibility to see to it that he does pay for that. You know, a typical thing to do is issue joint checks in the name of the contractor and the name of the relevant subcontractor or material supplier. And if the contractor doesn't pay him, and this happens a lot, sometimes, you know, contractors get into financial difficulties, they get paid, but they don't pay the people they owe money to.
Okay.
Those people have a claim against the owner.
Okay. Well, Tom, I really appreciate you talking with us. I have another guest we just have a few minutes to talk to, but you are awesome, and I'm going to tell everyone to use you if they need somebody to fight for them in court. So thank you so much, Tom, and have fun in New York.
Thank you, Joe. It's been great being on your program.
Thank you. Thank you. You're the greatest. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, Tim.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Hey, I'd like to introduce Tim. It's going to be
Did
a short...
I call early?
Well, you call a little bit late, but you can be on next week. But I wanted to introduce you. Tell us about the shows you've been on now.
Oh, definitely.
Tell us about your movie history.
My entertainment history. Comedy Central, American Body Shop was the show I was on, and I wrote for a local Phoenix guy named Sam Green wrote it, sold it to Comedy Central, and it was on in 07. So it's been a little while. I'm living in the past. That's the deal. What are you doing?
Well, we're working on some movies, and we're writing, and I know our time is running out, but we'll prime everybody for next week because we want to talk to you about the movie business, and how's life in L.A., by the way? Is it crazy or what?
Life is good. I just discovered what the problem was. I'm an hour behind, and I totally lost track of time, so it's all on me. So if you were plugging it, I'm just silly and stupid, and I apologize.
We'll do it next week because I want to tell everybody to listen to you. Now, you've helped write some of these shows, and you also write for other people, and you're going to be writing some movies. And yeah, we had actually talked, we're writing a movie now, kind of a Western adventure. And when you come into Phoenix from L.A., we'll have to have coffee again.
For sure. Definitely. You know, I love that story. You told me briefly about it. I'm from Phoenix originally, so that story is certainly back in my memory from when I was really young. So I'm excited to help in any way I can.
Oh, yeah. We'll definitely want you to be a part of it, and you can meet my partners, and we'll have a great time. So before we leave, tell us a little bit about Comedy Central or some of the fun times you had and the people you met there.
Okay, Comedy Central. The famous person...
Or any of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's fine. Okay, the famous person that everybody knows from the show that I was on is Nick Offerman, who was on Parks and Recreation, the mustache man, Ron Swanson. So a quick story about him. When we got picked up for the show and we were going to be on television, I called him and I said, Nick, hey, this is Tim Nichols calling to say... And he hung up. And I thought I must have had a bad... I know, right? I thought I must have had a bad connection. I was with another one of the actors on the show named Frank Marino, and I said, Frank, I think Nick just hung up on me. And Frank says, no, he wouldn't do that. Call him back. So I called him back again, and I said, Nick, hey, this is Tim Nick Click. He hung up on me again. And at this point, I'm irritated. I'm mad. I'm like, that's rude. And I'm just absolutely done with him. And about 10 minutes later, my phone rings, and it's Nick. And if you know the part he plays at all, he's very similar in terms of his cadence and how he speaks. And he says, Tim, I was playing a prank on you where every time that you called, I would not say anything. I would just hang up. And I thought that you would keep calling, but you stopped calling. In fact, I'll be honest, I'm mad that you already haven't hung up on me. So he was playing a prank. I didn't even know I was involved. I had no idea. He laughed with me in it, but he's a very talented actor, and as you know, you've seen a lot of movies now, and you'll, I'm sure, continue to see him in movies, and I'm just glad to know that he once hung up on me twice. So that's what gets me going in the morning. But well, I apologize sincerely that I missed...
Okay.
My time. I'm glad I got in. I'm
thank
sorry
you,
for that.
Tim. I hate to interrupt, but we've got 60 seconds. I appreciate you being on. We'll do
You're
it next
welcome.
Week. I'll tell all my friends, and we'll hear about what you're doing. It's going to be fun. So thanks a lot with Dr. Love Connection. This is Joe in Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks, Tim. We'll talk to
You're
you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.